This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are two professors from Kuwait University who are now living in exile in Virginia. They fear that the story of the Kuwaiti people is being drowned out by the heated discussions of the political issues underlying the war. Shafiq Gabra, Tigrid Al-Qudsi Gabra, and their two daughters escaped from Kuwait at the end of October after living under the Iraqi occupation for 3 months. Shafiq, who is the author of a book on Palestinians in Kuwait, is now teaching political science at William and Mary College. Tigrid has been doing public speaking for the group Citizens for a Free Kuwait. I spoke with them earlier today about their experiences in occupied Kuwait. The Gabras were living in campus housing at the university when the Iraqi army invaded.
That particular campus is on the sea, and it's on the outskirts of Kuwait City, and just adjacent to the port of Kuwait. And it was there where the Iraqis, after they crossed the borders and made it approach the city, that was one of the first places they put their hands on. And it was the shock of our life to realize that the Iraqis were on the main gate with tanks, weapons, hundreds of them over there. It was the shock of our life.
Was there a unified resistance on the university campus after the invasion?
It was summertime, okay, when the Iraqis invaded was August 2nd. There was a summer session. My last lecture was Wednesday, the day before, and it was on democracy and the future of democracy in the Arab world. And here Saddam Hussein invades and disrupts my theory, at least partially. And what I can say is that there was total collapse once the Iraqi army controlled the country. And what happened is that the whole country came to a halt. Banks, shops, the private sector, hotels, restaurants, cars, everything came to a halt. And this is where the resistance, and I would call civil disobedience and peaceful resistance, started by the Kuwaiti society as a reaction to the entire invasion. And that's when, in each Kuwaiti neighborhood, people were able to put together their life, take care of their medical needs, arrange their food needs, and be able. I mean, each of these neighborhoods looked like a commune, looked like an independent arrangement by itself, by which people will be supporting and helping each other and defying the Iraqis. And it took a lot of work to manage that, but it was managed. And at the same time, there was a military resistance started by a smaller portion of the Kuwaiti society. But the overall reaction was basically that of peaceful resistance and peaceful defiance.
Let me add, Terry, that even the young people and children in Kuwait participated in this spirit of voluntary work that spread among the people. Young people were carrying each other, wiping names of streets and numbers of streets to make it harder on the Iraqis to find or locate a certain house or a certain person. Schooling itself was starting to be organized from inside the houses in the different districts. So we were really trying to make our life as safe and as normal as possible under the occupation, at the same time send a strong and unconfused message to the occupier that we are really not dealing with the occupation. And for us, the teachers at the university, there was a strong argument going between ourselves whether to go and report to the Iraqi administration. We had a new Iraqi administration of the university that is armed. And we had a strong argument whether to try to go and report once the official summer holiday finishes or not. And maybe by this trying to protect as much as we can from our premises and from the institutions and the labs on the university campus.
What was that debate like among the university professors in deciding whether you should report to the new Iraqi officials at the university?
It part of us thought that if we go and report to the university, we may be able to convince them not to destroy, not to do anything to the labs, to the offices, to the computer equipment and everything. In the last few years, we've really spent a lot of money on the university campus, whether related to the buildings or to the facilities themselves. The other part of us said, well, no, we were not going to go and cooperate with the Iraqis, even if they destroy the university. I mean, they are destroying the whole country. and the university will not mean anything with a country completely destroyed. This argument was going on and on between us, back and forth, back and forth. In the meanwhile, they would call us to pressure us, to intimidate us. Later on, this pressure increased and it reached to an armed pressure even to come and go to the university. They wanted to create a feeling of normalcy. They wanted to bring the Kuwaitis to work with them. But at the same time, they were going destroying. So we said, I mean, these people are not really serious about opening a university or let it function. So we are not going to go and cooperate with them. And finally, we decided by consensus in the last meeting I remember we attended, there were several of our colleagues at the university. We decided that no one will go to the university. The university was already destroyed. Several of the libraries were already looted and destroyed. So it was a painful decision for us, a painful argument, but we had to make our message.
You are both Palestinian Kuwaitis, yes?
Yes, we are.
Was there a split within the Palestinian community in Kuwait about how to respond to the invasion? And I ask that since so many Palestinians are now siding with Saddam Hussein.
I mean, let me say the following. The Palestinian community in Kuwait and the Palestinian community in the Gulf and the Palestinian community in Saudi Arabia did not side with Saddam Hussein. And I definitely believe it's very important that this is made clear. And the reason they did not side with Saddam Hussein is that it was harder for Saddam Hussein to exploit to twist the facts and to exploit the emotions, because they were seeing what was going on and they were more in touch with the events around them. Palestinians in Kuwait didn't take them much to see what the Iraqis were doing in the country. It didn't take them much to see that the peaceful protest by the Kuwaiti society was met with immediate executions and a lot of torture and widespread looting, which touched as well Palestinian shops and houses and property and places.
Were there divisive debates within your circle of friends and colleagues about what the appropriate response should be, how to behave?
Yes, there was debate. There was debate. And one of the things I really ended up doing is be a go-between, my Kuwaiti circles and my Palestinian circles.
What was the difference between those two circles?
Let me put it this way. For the Kuwaiti society, the invasion itself, and it's from day one, it was clear that the Iraqis were totally after the Kuwaitis, after the structure of the economy of the country, after the Kuwaiti members of the army, of the elite groups, of the opposition, of all the forces. They were after the Kuwaiti people immediately. What the Iraqis tried to do is leave the rest of the foreign communities on the side, leave the rest of the non-Kuwaiti communities. And in this, coming with slogans and of pan-Arab nationalism, etc., they tried to pacify the Palestinians. On roadblocks, they would try sometimes to make differentiation in treatment. And so what was important here is for the Palestinians to have a debate. And that's what happened. They've had a debate regarding what was going on. And it didn't take much for the majority of the Palestinians to realize that the Iraqis intended to destroy Kuwait with all its population, whether it is Kuwaiti, Palestinian, Egyptian, Lebanese, American, whatever. I mean, this feeling later on of the Iraqis destroying the entire country really had its toll on the Palestinian community. And when I say go between, basically is that there was an important debate in the community, because you can't but have such a debate, given the fact of the PLO stand, given the fact of the feelings among Palestinians and Jordanians in Jordan, given the facts about the general atmosphere of Saddam exploiting much of the Palestinian plight and exploiting Arab nationalism and exploiting Islam. We had to have this debate, and it was successful.
Tigrit, I wonder if you feel betrayed by the Palestinians who support Saddam Hussein.
I don't think I can call it betrayed. I may call it disappointed, maybe. However, when I speak with my friends, Palestinian friends all around, whether in Jordan, whether here in the States, whether it's things got mixed up. Palestinians feel very much betrayed by United States foreign policy, by the Western world generally, by not pushing forward to a peaceful resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. They feel very betrayed, and they are very self-righteous about their sufferings, as any people who suffer would feel, I think. And when I talk with them, they sort of got lost too, between being against foreign intervention in the area, in the Middle East, and specifically American intervention, and being against Saddam Hussein. Most of my friends would say, no way we could side with somebody like Saddam Hussein. I mean, he's the most oppressive dictatorship in this whole area. We can never side with someone like that. It's only that we feel sort of a breeze or a relief that somebody is challenging the West. Somebody is saying no one time to the West. We have never been able to say no to the Western world. And just for saying that, they feel sort of relieved, even though I would say part of it is being disillusioned and part of it is being really desperate. I mean, the Palestinians are very desperate. And I could see it. I mean, being a Kuwaiti myself out of my country for 5 or 6 months is really painful enough. So let alone if this whole thing could drag, as in the case of the Palestinians, for 40 years. I do feel it because my family is still Palestinian. And I do know how it means and how it feels for them. That's why I wouldn't call it betrayal, because I think they feel betrayed themselves.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Dr. Shafiq Gabra and Tigrit Al-Qudsi Gabra. They were both professors at Kuwait University, and they escaped in October after the invasion. They're now living in exile in the United States. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Dr. Shafiq Gabra and Tigrit Al-Qudsi Gabra. They were both professors at Kuwait University. They escaped from the country at the end of October. Shafiq is now a visiting professor of political science at William & Mary College. He's also the author of the book Palestinians in Kuwait, The Family and Politics of Survival. Tigrit is now lecturing for Citizens for a Free Kuwait. And I should mention that they are both married. Were you exposed to brutality after the occupation? Was there brutality that you witnessed, or were you victimized yourself?
There were certain difficult moments, on at least a couple of times, where the soldier was about to shoot. And this is very difficult. The soldiers on the checkpoints or wherever in Kuwait do have open orders to fire. And they can, for anything suspicious, if they find any paper, if they... An argument, actually, a question not in the right, put not in the right way, whatever, can really cause brutality, can cause death, can cause execution. So we've had some encounters, and one of them actually was with the new dean, with the new Iraqi president of the university and the dean, as I was trying to salvage my furniture and my books from Kuwait University campus. He didn't like it, and I really had to answer to every item I had on the truck at gunpoint. And that was quite a surprise for me to see him really point a gun at me at the time, at checkpoints also. But the entire country of Kuwait came under a lot of brutality. I have friends and people I know who were executed. I have friends who were tortured. I've seen the marks on their bodies, severe torture. And there were people who were publicly executed. I mean, on daily basis, the time when I was there, basically August, most September, and most of October, on daily basis, you have 1 to 4 or 5 cases per day in such a small society like Kuwait, where the soldiers would bring a young Kuwaiti man and just shoot him in front of his parents, in front of his house. So it was really difficult to experience an occupation which really makes an onslaught on you from all directions, does not even give you a breath. And you add to all of that the constant looting of Kuwait. And that's, I mean, one of the worst brutalities one experienced is to see cars, convoys in the hundreds leaving Kuwait every night with refrigerators, radios, TVs, factory equipments. Kuwait buses have all been taken to Baghdad and are being used in Baghdad right now as transportation buses. School buses were all taken, books, libraries, everything that is movable have been taken. All the seashore area, beautiful residential areas on the sea of Kuwait, on the coast of Kuwait, most of the buildings there have been looted entirely.
If I may add, Terry, I think people sometimes are really astonished about our reaction, how strong our reaction to the Iraqi occupation, especially our fellow Arabs. And I keep discovering this when I'm going around and talking with them and with everybody around. I think the brutality, the severity of the occupation and its brutality in Kuwait had made our reaction so strong to it. We couldn't believe it. It was so painful for us to watch the whole country being looted bit by bit. I kept feeling that, you know, I'm at a point where I really don't feel what's private and what's public there. It all became one to me. Suddenly we had pictures, big pictures of Saddam Hussein around the country, all over the place. We had big statues for him all over the place. Our whole world was suddenly, as small as it is, was suddenly changing and being shattered for us. In addition to the torture and the rape and the killing of and the pillage of the country and its people, it made really a very strong impact on us and made our reaction as a result very strong, I would say.
Why are Arab Americans surprised at the strength of your reaction?
Because to them, I mean, this matter should still stay as an Arab matter. This matter should be solved among Arabs. And they get angry at us for allowing ourselves to be helped by non-Arabs, by people from the outside. And I respect this. And to me, it really is more respectable and more dignified even to be able to have an Arab solution to this whole problem. But unfortunately, and objectively speaking, the Arab world is so divided and so separated as never before even. And to add the Kuwaiti problem to the Palestinian problem, to the Lebanese problem, was out of the question for us as a Kuwaitis. We didn't want this whole thing to continue. And we knew we are a small country. We don't stand a chance of doing anything to the Iraqi forces or getting our country back if it weren't for other countries to help us in this matter. And our reaction is really very strong as a result of the oppression we were faced with. We know that this oppression has been going on and on for the Iraqi people themselves since Saddam Hussein has gained power in the country. But it was always, as we would say, out of our doorstep.
Tigrid, can you tell me how you escaped from Kuwait?
Well, fortunately, I have a little daughter who's 4 years old now, who was born here in the States when I was getting my PhD. So she qualifies as an American evacuee. I was permitted to accompany her. However, I was advised of disposing of all my Kuwaiti documents in Kuwait before I get to Iraq. Unfortunately, in Baghdad, they suspected that I was a Kuwaiti or married to a Kuwaiti, and they prevented me from continuing on the evacuation flight. I joined another group of like 60 women and children held in Baghdad for the same reason. Until I was able to identify some false identification papers and convince them that I wasn't Kuwaiti. And as a result, I took a minibus with another group to Amman, Jordan, and from there to the States.
So you both got out separately?
Yes, we did.
Shafiq, how did you get out?
Yes, well, I stayed behind for an extra month till the end of October. And literally, I did two things. The first, I had a very dear friend of mine who allowed me to borrow his passport. So I used his passport to leave Iraq, and I also had to provide a bribe to an Iraqi official whom I didn't meet. Someone in between arranged this for me. A friend of mine arranged this for me. And that person also helped process the papers inside the border point where I left out of Iraq into Amman, Jordan.
Tigreed, I know you feel very strongly about your country, Kuwait, but women don't have the vote in Kuwait, right?
No, they don't. Actually, Kuwait is really, in the Western sense, is an evolving democracy. So many things were coming to us on the way, so many things we were working for. So these things were coming on the way.
Do you feel any resentment at all when you read about the people in the royal family of Kuwait who were living at really high-priced hotels and spending their nights at Egyptian discos? We've, I think, all been seeing articles about that in the American press.
Terry, I mean, we can take this in two directions.
Yeah.
The first one is that Kuwait was a country which was all built on sharing. And there was a lot of sharing between the ruling elite and the rest of the society of Kuwait. Wealth was not really used in a bad way. It was mostly used to build a modern country, one of the best welfare systems in the Middle East. One of the highest per capita incomes in the world. It was used to make schools, to build modern highways and roads, to create a population which was before 1950, 80% illiterate, 90% illiterate. Now it has one of the high literacy rates in the Arab world. So much of that wealth was really used intelligently and productively. Now, to say that there are individuals who have done certain behavior, given a bad image, I would say that this is exactly what happens in every society. Every society, when it is involved in such a situation of exile, you're going to have different behaviors by different people. But the population of Kuwait at large can speak for themselves. So to really pinpoint one dancing or 10 or 20 in a disco in Cairo or elsewhere is really something the media would be interested in, but it does not represent but a fraction of the Kuwaiti society. So,
Do you want to return to Kuwait when the war is over?
Yes, I do want to return to Kuwait because I want to be part of the rebuilding of the country, and in particular of Kuwait University. This is something I feel I ought to do, and it is important for me to be part of it.
Shafiq Gabra and Tigreed Al-Qudsi Gabra are professors from Kuwait University who are now living in exile in Virginia, where Shafiq is teaching political science at William & Mary College, and Tigreed is working with Citizens for a Free Kuwait. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.